Hatha Yoga and Human Evolution by Steve Dwelly, 2018. So, just to begin with a note to listeners, I've had a blog up on my website since 2006, slowly adding posts. I invited readers to view each post as a chapter in a book I'm writing, but I was never very happy with the blog format because it seemed that newer posts buried older ones and prevented any kind of sustained development. So I've gone through the whole thing, keeping the basic framework of the last four posts I wrote as bones to be fleshed out, adding a new one to start things off, which is the Signet chapter, and combing through the gravel of the older posts, preserving the worthwhile nuggets and integrating them into the new book format. It was a rat's nest. I found so many loose ends. I labored on and on, searching out and eliminating repetitions, verifying questionable claims, making it readable. Those who have already read the blog will find familiar pieces of writing, but the overhaul was such that it's really a whole new, hopefully cohesive thing. Chapter 1 offers a basic cosmology that lays a groundwork for many of the claims made by the yoga tradition. I need to handle professional philosophy's attacks here because much of the rest of the book takes the subtle realm for granted. Chapters 2, 3, and 4 cover similar territory to each other from three different perspectives. All three present a view of a mature Hatha Yoga process and how it can attain to the highest yogic values, which I hold to be the highest values humanity has come up with. Chapter 5 addresses again the threat to these values from materialist doubters who at first blush, and multiple blushes thereafter, can be quite intimidating to the spiritually inclined. This book contains some paradoxes. Here's a big one. If much of yoga is about quieting the mind, what's with all this thinking? In particular, some of this seems pretty intellectual. Why should a yogi care about that? My answer begins with my claim that meditatively oriented yoga makes you smarter. And it also conspires to bring the practitioner towards and into the subtle realm. When one's soul begins consciously moving about in the subtle realm, the subtle nature and subtle footprint of thought becomes evident. And quiet mind and thinking mind take on its takes-two-to-tango relationship. Many yogis have been non-intellectual, but fewer of them non-intelligent. The paradox lies in the fact that to get going with yoga, we need to make efforts to control discursive mind and may go through phases where engaging yoga-related ideas is the last thing we want. But I found that getting a grasp of the larger yogic landscape is enormously beneficial, and I regularly get requests from students for concepts, talks, things to read. Sometimes people extend a critique towards self-oriented practices such as yoga, claiming that there are far more pressing issues to be engaged. My response is this. Let's take the potential human and sentient creature disaster of global warming as a suitably pressing issue. Any success addressing this requires not just technological skill, but also, and at this point according to scientists mostly, political success. In democracies, a high level of awareness spread throughout the populace is needed for the political will to tackle the risks perceived by cutting-edge thinkers. People need to evolve in order to cast votes, which will give us a chance to survive. Meditative Hatha Yoga, practiced on a regular basis over time, is the finest tool I'm aware of towards human individual development, and this book is an attempt to back that claim up. Not just trying to help others evolve, but being an example of evolution oneself is needed now more than ever. I chose to present this as a free online book and a free podcast as opposed to self-publishing or e-publishing as a print-on-demand, primarily because it is a constant work in progress and a life work. My intention is to continually add to, update, and revise this. Also, I've been told that my yoga studio has an intimidation barrier to entry for some, which I'm not sure is warranted, so I wanted to make this writing as easily accessible as possible. May it shed light on your path. Chapter 1, Signet. The Big Five, sight, sound, smell, touch, taste. These are the gross senses, the blatant senses, expressing the body's adaptation to light, vibrations in the air and other mediums such as water, particles in the air, matter, and chemicals in food, respectively. And there's a sixth, which I'll attempt to elaborate in this chapter. Let's call it internal subtle feeling, which picks up information from its own landscape. It reveals another dimension of the terrain represented by the Big Five, as well as getting into regions of experience that the Big Five can't perceive. These other regions exist in what we can call the subtle realm. Internal feeling has its own gross, blatant component, which can be roughly divided into two terms: proprioception, which physiology tells us comes from muscle placement and movement, and interoception, which covers pain, pleasure, and internal organ sensation. But if one maintains attention over time on the information from interior sensation, that sensation capacity will begin to register subtler phenomena which don't have obvious location in everyday space-time. A truly vast terrain containing subtler things begins to present its contours through such a practice. This subtle sensing may be given as a gift to some people from cultural familial heritage, or genetics, or accidental disposition, but for many of us it will need to be developed with practice over time. I'll make the claim here that internal subtle feeling, ISF for short, is an emergent capacity in humans that is just getting going at this point in human evolutionary history. Although reaching back 2,000 years, we can already find it well underway in literature from India and Greece, for example. This amount of time is still quite recent in the development of our biology. For at least that long, practitioners and thinkers in India have been pondering the processes captured by the Sanskrit term shukshma indriya, which means subtle senses. And the subtle realm came to be seen there as a step toward realization of higher goals in yoga. My idea of ISF is a development upon shukshma indriya. I believe ISF will evolve far beyond where it typically operates right now in your average human. Now, in our contemporary situation, it is not really possible to claim that the phenomena disclosed through ISF can qualify as scientifically proven in the full rigorous sense of the term scientific. This is because the confirmation of exactly what is perceived by checking it with and against the perception of others is difficult to do with anything resembling the overwhelming robustness of shared experience that the Big Five offer every second of our waking lives. But that doesn't make it impossible to undergo a personal and communal confirmation process, and doesn't make it untrue, and doesn't make it unempirical. In fact, I'm claiming here that the things that are disclosed by ISF and the landscapes containing those things and the processes involving those things are cognitively significant in every way demanded by even the logical positivists at their most severe. And the future will very likely see the transformation of this realm from merely empiric to actually scientific. Trends such as consciousness hacking work with methods and instruments that show how this may play out. ISF is cognitively significant because with gift or development, the realm can be robustly experienced as real, just as real as any of the Big Five moment to moment. Similar to outward vision, it can become stable and present in real time, and it does not deliver information subject to whim or present to us merely what we want to perceive. Rather, it faithfully presents data that is then turned into a dimension of our overall sensory representation. It also offers up a landscape whose features are enduring and re-identifiable. Since Kant, in philosophy, has more or less been recognized that when we see a tree, what we're really doing is taking raw data from our visual system and then applying mental categories to that data. Discoveries in neuroscience, which have been integrated into cognitive science, lean toward affirming and building upon Kant's view. We take raw colored patches and then make them into a tree with our mind, the process completed before we recognize that it has happened. Two people see the same colored patches and both call it a tree because both of their minds are using essential facts shared in variation by all minds to arrange those colored patches into a tree. This approach to vision, in all senses, sees them as generating a representation, which is created within our own minds. Applying this process to ISF, we can say this. We internally feel processes and contours and then attempt to organize that raw data into things that can be recognized. I say attempt because my position is that both our biology and experienced minds are still only at the infancy state in the subtle realm. Despite this, I've noticed that, especially in India, the subtle realm is taken for granted and, at least in basic ways, used as part of the daily routine in spiritual circles, and stable adaptation within the subtle realm is often seen as necessary toward realization of the next step, that of the witness or emptiness. That being said, I've been struggling to understand the subject for 25 years, and I'm often at a loss as to how to interpret both the things I'm perceiving as well as the lay of the landscape in which those things reside. I have discovered many things, however. One exceptionally interesting aspect of ISF is that it discloses a field that we can operate within and alter in a way quite different than how we alter the landscape perceived by our other gross senses. For example, if we see a shovel against a wall, we can walk over to it, pick it up, and move it against a tree. When we then stand back and look, we have altered the visual landscape we see. By contrast, in ISF, the subtle objects perceived are directly responsive to actions from what we can call the subtle body, Sukshma Deha in Sanskrit. We can affect things in this realm, but like the shovel, we can't affect them any way we want. If you try to mold that shovel into a ball with your hands, you're going to run into splinters which follow laws that you cannot simply overcome or ignore. In a similar manner, the objects in the subtle realm are also governed by laws, although they can be said to have greater plasticity than gross matter. In dreams, we may very well mush that shovel into a ball, and dreams are one mode of expression of the subtle realm. But even though dreams can manipulate gross data, such as images, in ways that can't happen in the gross waking realm, there are still forces in the dream world which are real and only can be fluently navigated once they are accepted and understood. A good pitcher in baseball has not altered physics, but has found ingenious ways of working with it. Likewise, an accomplished yogi or shaman with the laws of the subtle realm. Some have called these laws aspects of a fifth fundamental force in addition to the four accepted by science, namely gravitational, electromagnetic, and strong and weak nuclear forces. Let's call this theoretical fifth force subtle force. Other suggested names include pranic or akashic. Another possibility places it within the electromagnetic field, suggesting that our nerves have an ability to be profoundly sensitive to such forces in a way that transcends normal space-time. It could potentially be explained within causal closure, meaning that it might fit into the materialist worldview without any need for an unexplained spirit behind it, or could be related to quantum gravity, which humans haven't figured out yet. It may involve dark matter, which makes up 26.8% of the universe, or dark energy, which makes up 68.3%, both of which we know next to nothing about. Ordinary matter makes up 4.9%. 95% of what's out there and in here is still basically unknown to the sciences. The preeminent way to develop this sensing capacity is through the yoga arts, which specifically teach practitioners to develop non-discursive mind, or what I've called yoga mind, and I go much more into that in the yoga mind chapter. Skeptical thinking mind won't do it. Yoga mind reveals the underlying internal landscape that has accompanied thinking mind all along, a landscape of which most people are only vaguely aware. This landscape is not lingua formal, not language-based, not discursive. Conceptually, biological would capture it better, although it's not totally biological. Our biology works in concert with the psi-net. For the skeptical scientific materialist out there, my first question is, how much yoga have you done? Why do I ask? Simply due to the fact that it's difficult to get accurate with or even consciously sense subtle data without sustained, non-discursive, internal focus over time. My current experience with long experience in the yogic arts is that as soon as I free myself from discursive mind in the moment, ISF presents itself plainly, clearly. With practice over time, it has gotten clearer. Like outward vision, it can be experienced as something quite amazing, but often it is just there, matter of fact, a source of information. What does ISF disclose. I'm currently calling it the Cynet. It could be called the World Wide Web before computers. Great chain of being could work. In this post, I'm also referring to the underlying realm in which the Cynet exists and functions as the subtle realm. Each person is a node on this net and a source of energy, actions, and information out into it, as well as the receiver of energy, actions, and information from it. In one solo backpack where I slept under the stars and engaged a bear in the middle of the night and a bobcat the day before, I came to conclude, in agreement with Native American views, that animals are nodes on the net as well. The bear was somewhat crude, but 2 days' hike into the backcountry with no people anywhere near, its signal wasn't weak. I've also had an unusually clear dream where a blue whale out in the Santa Barbara Channel communicated colorful psychic shapes to me. Was it just a dream, or can there be something more to just a dream? My answer to that is this. Dreams are the most powerful and obvious place where the Cynet presents itself to most people. The overlay of the states of sleep under the states of spiritual development is well known, and it goes back into India from Upanishads predating the Common Era. Even the least spiritually inclined person goes to both the subtle realm while dreaming and the causal realm while in deep sleep every night. Yogis and other kind of mystics go there while wide awake with practice. We enter the subtle field with our subtle senses operating, undergo events with other people or animals or other entities, in subtle landscapes with subtle objects, enacting the Cynet. Those people with whom we are involved in our daily life will be our primary companions in our dreams. We can draw an analogy here from neuroscience, which tells us nerves that fire together wire together. So, people that hang together dream together. We can liken the Cynet to a huge global brain, each sentient being a neuron. We need to work things out with others in the subtle realm where we meet them in their subtle body in subtle landscapes. The profound part of this is that we need to do this to sustain health, intelligence, and even to survive. Those who don't adequately sleep and dream die before their time. In the scientific literature on the ways that dreaming sleep contributes to the brain's ability to organize information is extensive. My view on the process is that there is a physical component and a subtle component to dreaming. Again, an interaction between biology and the Cynet. The further implication here is that there is a healing aspect to the subtle realm, and my claim is that conscious or sleeping forays into the subtle realm exert organizational pressure on the body-mind. This happens to both recently gathered data, such as that which is still held in the hippocampus, as well as to more established knowledge and abilities. There's a growing body of literature on how yogic practice has actually increased the size of the brain, including the thickness of cortex. The standard materialist contention to much of what I've said so far is that higher yogic states are just alterations in brain chemistry, and in yoga we are merely experiencing the way such alterations feel and their various dynamics. Lab evidence mentioned in the previous paragraph is now convincing, so materialists need to see the fact of brain and chemical changes basically deemed positive by the health sciences. But they can still argue against the Cynet, against the idea that ISF is sensing anything outside of ourselves, against any idea that it functions as the activity of a sixth sense organ, such that psychic communication becomes possible. My response is this. Denial of the Cynet, made by those who don't understand ISF, can be dismissed outright because the relevant data is not going to show up in that lab. Those taking on an ISF-oriented practice, including any skeptical materialist willing to undergo a few years of yogic training, will most likely experience an internal field that grows in vividness and detail over time. Informed by this attained skill, they simply cannot with any assurance make the claim that what they are experiencing is not a representation of something out there. Skepticism is one thing, which I support, but flat-out denial is altogether different, and likely as a result of feeling threatened. I'm with Kant here. Our senses are a representation created within our body minds in a high percentage attempt to successfully grapple with whatever is out there. I've had extensive experience with ISF daily in my work life as a yoga teacher with rooms full of people doing yoga, to the point where I have as little doubt that what I'm feeling is as real as I have with what I'm seeing. I sense things with ISF, and I apply categories to them. In turn, the resulting concept of the signet presented here is well supported through spiritual literature and testimony as a way of organizing ISF data. Many, many others have come to the same concept. When faith groups such as Christian churches practice prayer, they're attempting to tap into the signet. A percentage of people in the West in sports, business, and politics take psychic communication as a given, either through prayer centered in the Judeo-Christian matrix or from more esoteric sources. Scientific studies on the effectiveness of prayer have not panned out too well, but this has much to do with the environment in which the studies were carried out. Psychic exchange studies have been conducted with statistically significant confirmations, especially when they've been done with people who have shown subtle realm familiarity. You can Google Russell Targ or the Parapsychology Lab at Duke University or look up Rupert Sheldrake. Despite this, such studies often don't hold up well in the scientific lab. Well, just as sleep is susceptible to disturbance, so are subtle realm operations. Dreams are often ephemeral and difficult to remember in the glaring face of waking consciousness. Likewise, achieving specific psychically transmitted data in a lab, for example, mind reading the number on a card that a person is repeating in her mind, unfortunately often kills this more sophisticated aspect of the subtle realm. Which is to say, my claim is that there is an aspect of the subtle realm which allows transmission of actual mental discursive content, such as a number or complete thoughts, but the more reliable and more routine subtle exchanges are that of feeling-based content, which is a different kind of data than labs can typically measure, and is often less about specific discursive information and more about what one's subtle body is expressing, which can be emotions and their subtle extensions, such as feeling someone's anger or confusion. This sensing often picks up feelings that the person who is having them may not be aware of or is in denial of. Also note, unfortunately, the Judeo-Christian tradition provides few tools to the average layperson for the practice and development of psionet skills, and has even violently suppressed them at times. The subtle realm can be used for good or bad, consciously or unconsciously. In fact, I will claim that it is a substrate to everybody's experience at all times and perhaps ironically provides the fullness with which we recognize our representation of reality to be robust and real through the connections that we have with others which contribute an underlying interrelatedness feeling tone to our moment-to-moment conscious experience. I say ironic because for many people this feeling tone barely and rarely consciously registers. This is to say that although we likely perceive and engage inanimate objects by using the Big Five, when it comes to perceiving and engaging sentient beings above some threshold intelligence level, ISF, internal subtle feeling, enters the story in addition to the Big Five, whether the participants in that story are aware of it or not. Good subtle realm engagement, helpful to others, healing positive, is an art that can be cultivated. Again, some have a gift for it, but most of us will have to work hard at this. The yogic arts reveal capacities in this regard that can be developed within ourselves to likely an endless degree. Masters in this realm often hover around the healing and spiritual arts, for example, yoga teachers, therapists, clergy, gurus, but they're also scattered around all fields of human endeavor. Many parents share this bond with their children, although this can happen in a range from helpful to non-helpful, conscious to unconscious, as can subtle exchange between any two people. The more intense and intimate the relationship, the stronger the mutual transmission. Intense relating includes love as well as strife and conflict. Effects can be transmitted from afar, even across space and time, but those who are closely situated in space-time will make the strongest connections with the potential for the most transformation. A good metaphor here, which is likely more than just a metaphor, is that our exchanges with another person place in both of us a transmitter and a receiver, and the more frequent or intense the exchange, the bigger these devices get. Our circle of people receive what we transmit and vice versa, like radios. When I put my hands on someone in class, the sense connection increases greatly and a field of exchange presents itself clearly. As the years of my practice have accumulated, the ISF perception of the field between me and the person I'm engaging gets more elaborate, allowing a process of recognizing enduring landscape features. It has also allowed for the development of layers of subtle skills, which in the hooked-up relationship field can transform subtle things into more mature and integrated versions of themselves. In a class setting, it's not just me doing this, but a collaborative effort conducted at various levels of consciousness. Some students seem aware that they're doing this, others less so. This non-discursive direct field engagement work in turn exerts evolutionary pressure on the current states of our body, minds, and the various contents therein. Organization at the subtle level has a trickle-down effect into denser regions, as well as clearing the way for even more subtle work. Psychotropic drugs can offer an experience of the subtle realm which makes our subtle connection with others seem undeniable. These drugs provide an experience akin to vivid dreaming, but while still awake. However, one of the many problems with drugs is that when they wear off, we may wonder if the disclosures were real or not. On the contrary, stable, consistent yoga practice offers a stable, consistent access to the subtle realm, which makes it as real as the gross realm shown by the Big Five. Internal subtle feelings steadily develop with strong, arduous practice as an inherently evolutionary act, and while contributing to material development, it has its fullest power towards gaining comprehension in the spiritual realms, where it can slowly put in place a subtle state which is as stable and enduring a body-mind state as one can have. Hard work sculpts psycho-architecture slowly but surely and securely. On the other hand, the fundamental contribution of psychotropics is exceptionally unstable and temporary. Once the drug is metabolized out, the resulting restructuring of the psyche may attain to degrees of permanence, for better or worse, but the wire to nirvana is gone. Compare this to the yogi who wakes up the next morning with a higher state still there, often not dramatic or profound or mind-blowing, but simply, beautifully, even mundanely, present.